This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today I have with me
Arnie Evans.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Arnie, we were talking about your experiences in radio and TV broadcasting. But what sort of, in the 70s and 80s, what sort of facilities did you have?
Big difference between the two. Basically, all we had in radio was a radio car, which if we begged and pleaded, we might be able to tear away from the advertising people for half an hour to go out and do something that you can do on a cell phone now. And the rest of it was all done by telephone. So we had a really tiny budget. That changed hugely when I went
by
to television.
By telephone?
So. Yeah, you basically phoned somebody up and interviewed them over the telephone, okay. Recorded it, and then edited it yourself there. Everything was done with a team in TV. We weren't anything like the BBC, who used to send out such a big reporting team that they had to have two vehicles. We only had three or four people going, but still it was much more complicated. And then when you got back, the editing was done by a huge team too.
Yeah.
So you really had to be a team player.
But hang on, going by telephone, you got quality recordings that way? The phone was linked up to a recorder?
Yep, we had a huge recording desk, the thing that we actually used to do our news bulletins from, all set up there.
So you'd use a special phone that's all...
Yeah, it was plugged in it. You had a microphone on your end. You get telephone quality on theirs. But we didn't do an awful lot of what we called actuality anyway. Most of the stories were you phone somebody up and talk to them. And then you'd write your story out, and you'd read it, or the newsreader would read it.
So you weren't actually broadcasting what they were saying.
No. Most of the sound bites, as we called them, that were on air, or the actuality, as it was called in those days, most of that was done with a microphone going out and seeing somebody face-to-face. But we'd only have maybe one or two or three of those a day out of a dozen stories.
So what was the process then? You'd say to someone while you talk, okay, I'll be recording this now, or did they know?
Yes, you would certainly never record anything without first telling somebody you intended to.
Okay, so
illegal.
You talk to them a bit and then say, okay,
Or at the beginning you'd say, I just want to do it. Can I do a quick phone interview with you over so and so? And you know, I'll start recording now, so that they knew.
Yeah.
But most of the time, as I said, you were just taking notes.
Yes.
Or as I should have said. Whereas with TV, you had to go there because you had to have the film. So you only could do one story a day. But you had all sorts of facilities. I could hire a helicopter if I wanted to, which was, even in those days, $1,500 to call out a helicopter.
A day or an hour?
To get it there. Then they started the hourly charging.
Yeah.
The camera crews were paid $400 plus another $400 for every hour after that. So it was a huge budget compared to radio. I mean, that was more than we paid in reporters for a, you know, for one story. They'd spend more on one story than we'd spend in radio on a week of stories.
So they'd have to actually use just about everything they did, would they?
They didn't shoot much. They didn't use. Well, nobody did actually, even in radio, because the budgets didn't allow it. You'd edit it down a lot. Getting there was the big cost, of course. You know, getting the crew there and everything, you could shoot them up. We were allowed 10 minutes worth of film, and that's basically because it took too long to process.
Yes.
So it was a time constraint rather than a financial one. But, of course, television made so much money from advertising compared to radio. And, you know, you could stay overnight in places and all that sort of stuff with your crew. Yeah. But at the same time, you had a lot less freedom because you were told, in radio, we basically sent a reporter out saying, cover, find out what's going on. And they came back with their version of it. I was quite shocked when I got to TV and was told what I was to, what the story was before I got there. And and it was
so sort of, there's other people, they've got other, not reporters as such, but people finding stories.
There was a whole team doing this sort of editing job too, what would have been done by one person called a chief reporter in radio,
but
and
to
two
find
people.
The stories in the first place.
It was basically well, again, you had Brownsman who covered their rounds, a police reporter, parliamentary reporter, and on and on and on and on for network. But for the local news, yes, basically just journalists. People would ring you in and ring you up and tell you about things, of course, that they wanted to get on air and that sort of thing.
No, but you were saying you'd be told what the story was and what to do. So
the editor would say, this is a story about such and such, and I was quite shocked when it got back, and I remember the first time I got out there and found the story was different and did it that way. And when I got back, I was hauled across the coals because that's not the story I was told to do.
Okay.
I couldn't believe it. This actually is one of the things that made me not reluctant to leave television when I finally did, culminated in when they were getting really frightened about the imminent arrival of TV3, getting an American chap over who taught us what he called the five-word commitment. And at 9:30 in the morning, these team would have got together and decided what the stories for the day were going to be, and you would be called up and told, this is your story and here are the five words that describe what your story means. And you had to commit to that was the story you would bring back.
I mean, those words have to go into the story?
For example, let's say superhuman efforts by firemen prevent so and so such and such. And if you get out there and find that it wasn't actually that, that what actually happened was the whole team had done so and so, and this guy's saying it, and on, you better not come back with that story. Mm. You better come back with the story that this individual's a hero.
Okay.
And that just...
And who
I just
decides
thought, I don't
that?
Want to do
Where
that.
Does that come
this,
from?
This
it?
Group of... Group of the editorial staff in their morning conference.
Okay, that would be a good story.
Yeah, this is a good story, and this is the way we're going to handle it, and this is what it means. And I just thought, boy, I don't want to be around there anymore. That was in the late 80s.
Okay.
So I was happy to leave. But that was a big transition from radio, where you were flying solo.
Well, there was a stage when I was the go-to as an economist, the go-to person to report on certain things, and I get the morning radio people phone up. But when they start to say, "We want you to say this," I thought,
"Yes, no, I'm sorry, no,
that's,
no,
that's not
no,
work.
It doesn't but work that way."
Did you find then, and I suppose there might be a difference in radio to TV, but people being reported and feeling that the issue wasn't reported properly? Do you get much feedback that way?
Don't know how much that happened with television, because the complaint would have come in at a much higher level, and it would have only filtered down to me if there's something they felt that I needed to change.
Okay.
That things like that did happen, of course. I mean, basically, sometimes it was mistakes you made. Like I remember once when, with television, you'd have two or three people up talking, and we'd put up captions under them to show which was which person. I got the captions backward and said Mr. A was Mr. B and so forth.
Okay.
And I remember the boss hauling me in and lecturing me for about 15 minutes. And as he finished, he said, "Now, Arnie, I want your assurance that it'll never happen again." And I looked at him and said, "Pat, it'll never happen on purpose. I promise you that." There were other ones where it was just... Oh, the funniest one was...
Just a minute. So you did your own captioning, or someone else did that,
You were the only person who knew their names, so you were responsible for it. that somebody else.
So you get to look through the final version before it's broadcast and sign it off?
Or? No. Okay. No, you sent it to the guy who was in charge of the captions.
Yeah, you know, okay.
No. Your job is done. I can remember one which wasn't really my fault, but resulted in a similar sort of talk when there was a riot among the secure inmates at Lake Alice, and they took over the dining hall. And we were sent over there to film, and you, of course, couldn't get anywhere near it. All the reporters were standing around together. And I knew my deadline was, absolute, utter deadline was 4 o'clock. I had a chap sitting in halfway between, sitting at Sanson, a taxi driver who was very dependable, and we'd get the film down as fast as he could. I was going to leave at 4 o'clock, rush to Sanson, hand it to him, go and phone from a local dairy and say the film's on its way and here's the facts. So nothing had happened. We took this pretty much nothing film and shot over there with it and on. I phoned through and said the film's on its way, and they said, what about the helicopter? And I said, what helicopter? And they said, we've sent you a helicopter. You don't have to get the film there this quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing to be done. I had sent the cameraman, who was Brian Lurkey, home to Whanganui, where he lived.
Yeah.
The film was on its way to Wellington.
Yeah.
I had no camera crew.
Yeah.
I drove back to Sanson and shook hands with a helicopter pilot and sent him back to Wellington.
Yeah.
And boy, did the repercussions for this were not good, because if I had actually known the helicopter was coming, we would have got the whole story, because it did break up very quickly after that.
Yeah.
So the next time I went to Wellington for the next 5 weeks or so, a new boss, I discovered how many bosses I had, would come up to me and say, now, Arnie, about this mistake you made in, about the helicopter and on, they finally got together and worked out that I should phone in every 15 minutes when I was out on a job to just see if they had any messages for me. Yeah. Now, this is...
So you hadn't been told about the helicopter?
No. Okay. There's no way to tell me. This is before cell phones.
Yes.
You know. They gave me... that's right, this 15-minute thing. So I was supposed to, wherever I was, drop everything, drive to find a telephone somewhere... Oh. And phone them. Go back for another, And if the phone was 5 minutes away, I was going to have 5 minutes filming time and 10 minutes driving, It just wasn't practical at all. But I was in no position to argue, so I just said, yes, thank you. And waited until there was a story I really didn't want to get on the air and did it.
Mm-hmm.
And the next five trips to Wellington, my five bosses came up and said, I think you've misunderstood us. You don't have to phone in every 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And they gave me a beeper, which only got used once when somebody beeped me and I drove an extra half an hour to get to a telephone. And he said, are you on your way down with the film? And I said, yes, I was, but it's going to be half an hour later. So sometimes the team stuff didn't work quite as well as it should when you were being a detached reporter like I was.
Yeah.
And you also had a lot more outlets to cover, too. I did stories sometimes, usually for Today Tonight, but there was also the Maori program, Te Kāre. There was the children's afternoon dispatch.
So you were doing Maori program?
Oh, those were interesting. I don't speak Maori.
Yeah.
But what I would do is I would go out and shoot the film, and they would give me the questions to ask in English, and I'd ask them in English. The person would reply in Maori, and then they'd edit them along with the film.
Put a voice in, yeah.
When it got back, so that they...
Now, I'd heard there was in, and I'm not sure where it was, but there was some sort of scandal where it might even have been in New Zealand, where there was some interviews happening somewhere else, and they were selling this to various stations, and the person in the studio was just dubbing over the questions as if they were actually interviewing them. Yeah.
Yeah. No, they what they did with this is they would have the voiceover that you had on a film introducing the next person. We ask him about so-and-so.
Yeah.
And then he'd say that. That this would all be in Maori, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the way they did it. It worked very well. Actually, I really enjoyed working for Te Kāore, though I wasn't too sure. The stories I was doing...
Was that because there weren't many Maori reporters at that stage? Or?
Well, there weren't many reporters anyway. Te Kāore, of course, couldn't command a great deal of the budget because it was a small audience. Mm. So they had a limited budget, and they had to do it on the cheap, too. Once Maori TV came in, of course, that improved hugely because they proved to be a great success. Yeah. The other remaining outlet was Eyewitness News, which was a 9 o'clock news. Well,
okay. Just going back, who made the decisions about what was covered on the Maori?
On Te Kāore. Oh, that was Derek Fox, I think, was in charge of it in those days. It was totally independent.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you were just doing that. They said, "Can you do
this?"
Yeah,
they would give you the questions. I presume go to the chap I phoned in every morning to. They would say to him, "Look, tomorrow, can you get Arnie to do this for us?"
Okay.
And so he'd say, "Oh no, what I want you to do is go out and do this Te Kāore thing.
Yeah.
Ring Derek, and he'll give you the questions to ask and so forth." And tell
now,
him what
would
film.
That be limiting? If you or was it standard procedure? You have preset questions rather than having some flexibility on that.
Usually you'd be expected to have some flexibility. But of course, it wasn't applicable this way because I didn't know what the person had replied. I had no idea what they'd said in it as an answer, so I couldn't do it. But it kind of worked. Yeah.
Were there many fluent people to interview then? They could speak Maori?
He'd always make sure that you were the person you were talking to. Yeah. They'd arrange all that.
Yeah.
So I was just kind of, pretending to be something I wasn't.
Okay. So you weren't actually on film, they were just showing the other
camera. You usually weren't. The way we did things in those days, we'd start with what was called a two-shot, which was the back of you and the face of the person next to you, and they'd introduce the person over, Aaron Evans, so-and-so, such-and-such.
Yeah.
I always said I could tell when any of my interviews were done by the size of the bald spot on the back of my head as it grew over the years.
Yeah.
The best thing about the two shots too is we'd had to do a kind of fake two shot afterwards. When the interview had finished, the cameraman would take the microphone away, take it off, and just shoot some film of me standing there talking to this chap. And I can remember we were up on the bridge to nowhere, up near up the Whanganui River, interviewing an old fella who had done. All the steel work. He'd been a teenager when his father and another man had built it, and he'd done all the bending, and Doc had just opened it up. And so we're interviewing him there. He was in his 70s.
Mm.
And we're out in the middle of this bridge doing the interview and everything, and then my cameraman, takes the thing away and says, "We'll do the two shot now," and he starts. And my job was to stand there, hold a mic with the wire on it, and talk to this guy nonstop until Maury told me to stop. And I'm going on, and I'm going on, and I'm going on. Maury's not told me to stop. I'm thinking, what's going on here? And I said finally to the old chap, "Look, I'm really sorry, but I have to keep standing here like an idiot and doing this until the cameraman says I should stop." And he said, "Oh, he left some time ago." There were funny bits in it. And the most wonderful thing about it was these people you met. I can remember a young fellow who won the Golden Kiwi Lottery, who was a shepherd up back of Rangawahia. Excuse me. When we finally found him, we were desperately short of time, and I was a bit in a big rush, and I missed the best thing because he said it to me... while we were rushing out to get him, and I didn't get him to say it again. It was really stupid. But I had said to him, "I thought you'd be, somewhere celebrating." He was drenching lambs. And he said, "Well, my wife's going into Thai Happy to get a new dress. We're going out to dinner tonight." And he said, "But I was the younger son, and my father said to me, 'Boy, if you want a farm, you're going to have to work like bugger or win the Golden Kiwi.'" And he said, I was doing the first, and now I've done the second. I realize once I get the farm, I still have to do the first. So that's what's scary.
And you know, now you also at Video Dispatch and Eyewitness News.
Yeah. The Video Dispatch was the children's news program that was on in the afternoon about the time you got home from school, I think. And the Eyewitness News was an evening, 9 o'clock sort of news program where you did slightly longer items for that. So they required a different kind of story, usually a longer story. And of course, the Video Dispatch ones would be of something about early teenagers, poor teenagers, and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So what sort of thing, what would they, how would they choose the items?
One I can remember was when Freiburg was the first high school here to get a lot of computers. And they were given 50 computers by a bank, I think it was BNZ. And I remember going out for the Video Dispatch to do this thing about the Palmerston North School that was switching over to all these computers.
I think it was an experimental unit together with Teachers College.
That's right, yeah. But I was really struck by the chap at the school who I was interviewing about it. And he said, it's hit our teachers one way or the other. He said, some of them, like me, really enjoy this opportunity to get the kids, you know, doing their own thing and learning. And he said, some of us, though, who are used to being the center of attention are finding it very difficult to have to walk up and tap a pupil on the shoulder and say, excuse me, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a bigger adjustment, I think, for the teachers than it was for the kids. But that's always true with age and anything relating to the internet.
Well, I think, it's had a major effect on teaching anyway, just the whole computer thing. Okay. And Eyewitness News, is there any major stories that you were involved in there?
No, I can remember one story I did about 5 minutes worth of stuff on battery hens, and it was funny actually. We started off. We basically cut the thing. This editor and I were devoted an entire evening to doing it, and we got it done in about 3 hours, and then we decided we'd have some fun. So we took some of the offcuts and made up a funny film, and luckily that never got to air. But it was included in the annual. All the reporters would get together and make little contributions to a kind of funny film that we watched in the newsroom, and that made it into that. But no. Usually my job was rats and mice, as we call it. You know, if anything was really big, like, for example, when the Wanganui computer, there was a chap who blew himself out, just smithereens in the doorway. That they sent a Wellington reporter up to do that, one of their parliamentary reporters, and on and on. So the closest I got to big stories, usually really big stories, was sending film down for someone else to use.
Did you feel then that the Wellington, I would have thought probably being in the provinces, you would have had to cover a really broad range. So you got a broad range of experience, whereas the Wellington ones might be much
huge variety. I mean, you know, because you were doing farming stories you didn't have specialist reporters. I looked at one month, for example, I can remember where I did, a story on the congestion of bicycles going out to Massey University. I can remember a fact from it that for the 15 minutes before 9 o'clock, a bicycle arrived at Massey University every 3 seconds for a solid 15 minutes. That was the beginning of the four-laning of the road out to Massey.
Oh, and cutting down the trees.
And cutting down the trees and the whole thing. And it came out of kind of congestion. Yeah. Because... of course, it was very dangerous for the cyclists. There was no place to go except to weave around through the trees.
There was no cycle lane.
No. And there was only two lane. Yeah. There was almost solid traffic as well.
And that was the old bridge, which...
Yes.
Was there a cycle path? There was a pedestrian path, wasn't there?
There was a pedestrian walkway. Cyclists were... I can't remember whether they were allowed to use it or not, actually. I have a feeling it was originally pedestrian only, but whether they actually allowed them to, I don't know. But, of course, all of that fight. Okay, so that was one story. There was a fire at the showgrounds. The first of a whole slew of stories on the attempts to eradicate old man's beard from our environment.
So the fire at the showgrounds, that was...
It was in the grandstand. I don't think it was very big or very serious.
Okay.
But I don't think it was the one that burnt the grandstands down. I think it was overseas on holiday when that happened. There was a Ranfurly Shield preview, which is probably why I did the fire at the showgrounds, because we had a Ranfurly Shield match coming up. Although it might not have been us. I don't know if Manawatu had the shield.
An old man's beard eradication. I mean, in some of these, you think, well, how do you film a story like that?
Basically, there was a lot of good scenery in something like that, so you could probably do it and talk over it. You had good pictures for people to look at. I do remember later on going up to Thai Happy with the then, I think she was Minister of Conservation, might have been Minister of the Environment, one of the two anyhow, with Helen Clark to do a story, because that's where the old man's beard apparently came into the country. A farmer a little bit out on the... Thai Happy to Napier Road had brought some back from Hungary when he was on holiday and planted it in his garden and it escaped. We went up there and we filmed the bank where the cliff on the roadside where it was supposed to have come from and went down and did a lot of stuff, and I interviewed Helen Clark there. So that was my most memorable old man's beard thing when I talked to a future prime minister about it. We also, in that same month, I did a story on the Manawatu School Science Fair for the Video Dispatch. Savage Crescent, when they undergrounded all the wires, in Palmerston North. Savage Crescent had all these power poles around. There's a kind of hollow oval park in the middle of Savage Crescent. And they put them all in there. And they were right up against people's backyards on the corner. And a number of them, people had used them as one of the corners for a garden shed. They very kindly sawed the posts off and left people's sheds. I can remember that. That was good. And the last... there was an earthquake also. The last one I remember, it was this thing on irradiated food. Some Australian company was trying to sell food that had been sterilized by radiation to New Zealand. And I was assigned to interview them. And I had to, I remember I had to open this packet of shrimps and eat one of the cooked shrimps afterwards. And normally you'd finish it with Aaron Evans for Today Tonight. They told me, don't back announce it. The presenter will do that. And Roger Gascoigne, who was a presenter at the time, came on and said, that was Aaron Evans, who glows in the dark. So that was the sort of variety that I had in 1 month. There was all sorts of things.
Now, you mentioned earthquake.
Yes, that's right. I don't know what it was and where, but it was big enough. That was one that made the network news. And I can't for the life of me remember it. That actually, the clearest memory of a disaster around here I have was flooding. This was quite late in the 80s, and there was very serious flooding down toward the old harness track and so forth down there.
The harness track?
Down by the racing track.
The Awapuni race course, you mean?
The other one, the one over toward Dowfield Crescent and there. Two remarkable things. One was apparently the big breakthrough was in somebody's backyard when suddenly water from the stream had got up higher than stop bank, and it had come through what they call a pipe, just hollowed out the clay pipe, shot up in somebody's yard. They ended up putting two full truckloads of sandbags on it. It threw them off in a circle first, and that's basically what flooded the area. But anyhow, we were waiting around in the rain filming this, and the electronic camera, by then we were into videotape, packed up, didn't like the wet, and we rushed back home to my house and whipped out my wife's hair dryer and hosed it for about 5 minutes and went back out and started again. That one, and I remember a big fire up north. This was the one that, when I left TV, I thought I'd never have to do that again. But there was this huge forest fire started up back at Tai Happy in the bush and spread right across the Kaimanawas. Mm-hmm. And it was horrific. The helicopter pilots, after a while, refused to fly us in because the thermals from it were too dangerous. And this thing was raging around it. They dropped a bulldozer in at one point, and before they got the crew in, luckily, the bulldozer had been caught in the conflagration and burnt his billy-o. Another place where it jumped across the Rangitiki River, something like 100 feet in the air, mm-hmm. from one steep gorge to another, and they were sure that was going to stop it. And all the time, I was getting these phone calls from Wellington saying, have they got it under control yet?
Yeah.
And it was like saying, you know, have you actually stopped the sun from coming up?
Yeah,
I mean, it was going to...
It was just powerful.
And I said, no, we're still praying for rain. I can remember one stage, which did not actually amuse anybody down in Wellington very much.
This is part 2 of 3. Listen next week for part 3.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.